Hit it. The president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
When we do have secret prisons, that is not what America's all about.
Let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Good evening, America. Welcome to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Tonight, I have the honor and privilege of welcoming a very special guest. I get the chance to question a reporter who has probably questioned more presidents than any other person alive. She has been the dean of the White House Press Corps ever since she first interviewed President John F. Kennedy. And she's gone on to interrogate Johnson and Nixon and Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, Bush Jr., and now President Obama, with whom she shares a birthday. Helen Thomas, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
Tell me this. You have been around a while in Washington. What do you think in your reporting style stands out as something that has, kept you around? Lots of people come and go on the White House Press Corps.
Well, first place, I love my profession, and I hang in there, and I'm, willing to sweep the floors.
Willing to
stay
sweep
in
the floors.
It.
One of the things that interests me is that you began your life in journalism as a copy girl.
Copy boy.
A copy boy? Is that what they called them at the time?
Actually, we used to call ourselves copy boy because that was the only profession. I mean, it had always been regulated to boys.
And that meant what? Getting coffee and...
Getting coffee, cutting copy, like doing any chores, you know, just being a minion.
And you were willing to do anything to get into journalism.
Absolutely.
Now, why did you decide to go into journalism in the first place?
I was nosy.
You were nosy.
That was my first criteria. I think curiosity and working on the high school paper gave me a great sense of what the profession was all about and the ambiance. I loved working with the other journalists and learning a lot. And it's an education every day.
Now, you mentioned the high school newspaper. You grew up most of your life in Detroit, but you were born in a small town in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
Winchester, Kentucky.
Winchester. Mm-hmm.
And you're the child of immigrants, from what today would be called Lebanon, Tripoli, Lebanon, though then it was part of the vast Ottoman Empire when your family came.
It was Syria.
It was Syria then.
Mm-hmm.
And your father came in, I think, 1895,
mm-hmm.
right?
Roughly in that area.
So
maybe eight.
I'm curious to know, in growing up, well, of course, you lived in Kentucky a very short period of time, but in your book you point out there was actually prejudice against your father as an Arab American. People wouldn't sell him a home.
That's right.
To tell our listeners about what happened there.
Well, my father first had a little grocery store, or a push cart first, I think, then grocery store, and he loved the house on the hill. And when he came to want to buy it or being able to afford it, he was turned away because of his Arab background.
And the person who would sell him the home told him that, said, I'm not going to sell you because you're an Arab?
Oh, I think he knew it was discrimination. I don't think it was that blunt.
It wasn't that blunt. But at the age of 4, you moved to Detroit, and you mentioned the high school paper. You spent most of your growing up years in Detroit. What was Detroit like when you were growing up?
Wonderful. I think it's still wonderful, although so hard pressed now. 15% joblessness. Detroit, to me, saved the country in World War II. They transformed the auto industry into making tanks and planes almost overnight. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it was so clear that without Detroit, we could not have supplied defenses to countries and our allies and ourselves.
How do you feel, recently, Detroit's been in the news a lot. It's not been happy news.
No.
Of course, we've bailed out GM. Ford's in trouble. Chrysler went bankrupt. What do you think about Detroit and the American auto industry? You began in it, you know, your father moved there in its heyday when everything was bright and
well. Well, the 1920s weren't exactly, because they were about to go into another big depression. And so forth. but it gave us a lot of hope. And I think it was symbolic of what democracy was really all about. There was a German family on one side, Italian background, heritage, and everybody in the Depression, of course, was hungry and looking for jobs and depressed in a way. It was a depression, but there wasn't any kind of revolution except some people were thinking, wondering whether democracy was the right thing when they lost their jobs and the whole. But I think that we have always recovered from that. Detroit, to me, has been so vital.
And you went to college in Detroit, Wayne State
That's
University.
That's right, Wayne.
And
Wayne State University.
And then you ended up in Washington. Tell us how that happened.
Well, I had graduated from college. I was determined to be a journalist, and no one told me that it was a man's world. And certainly my family didn't. My father sent 9 children to college, and he didn't expect us to run the elevators, but never told us what to do in terms of what kind of a profession, that I had to be a nurse or a teacher and had the kind of security. So
of course, at that time, most women, about the best they could hope for professions, were to be a nurse or a teacher. And while those are honorable professions, they didn't try to be journalists.
Exactly. And my parents did not urge me to go into either of those. And I said I wanted to be a newspaper woman. So.
And they supported you. They had no question about a woman's role or anything.
No.
Like that.
In fact, for all of the children, our sisters and brothers really chose the professions they wanted. One was a nurse, another lawyer, and so forth.
But it wasn't easy as a woman to get into journalism, was it?
At that time, no. But there were a lot of women, newspaper women, who had really broken through, except the clubs were barred. The National Press Club, we couldn't get into her. And so women were kind of an oddity.
Well, how is it?
At World War II was the opening, because
the men were fighting, so the women would take over jobs.
Well, they were drafting every young man who had a pulse. If he was breathing, he was going to war. And so they found out they had to have women reporters.
So that's when women reporters really began, would be the 1940s.
Well, that isn't when they began, but that's when they got their big break.
When a lot of women were mm-hmm. in the field. So when you joined, you were a copy editor. Not a copy editor,
yeah.
A copy boy, I guess, as you call yourself. And that was for a newspaper.
It was for the Washington Daily News.
Which and doesn't exist anymore, I don't think.
No, it doesn't exist anymore, right? Like so many. But 8 of us, 8 reporters were fired because we were members of the American Newspaper Guild. Mm-hmm. And we asked for $5 more a week.
So you were involved in labor fights way back when.
Absolutely.
Now, were you personally involved in that request for $5 a week?
Of course.
You've always been someone who kind of attacks powerful people and speaks truth to power. I mean, here it is, you wanted to be a journalist from your earliest day. You have a foothold in the door, and you're already with a group of labor activists.
But I was a reporter for about 8 months, and I was fired as a part of the union now.
Wow.
And so we were all fired, and so we went knocking on doors, mm-hmm. most of the women, at the National Press Club, press building. And I did get into UPI and told them, looking for a job. And so the managing editor called the Washington Daily News managing editor, and they were both being paid by the same company,
Uh-oh.
Which was Scripps Howard, owned them both. And they said, yeah, give her a break.
It wasn't her fault that everybody quit.
That's right. So then I stayed there for 57 years.
57 years at UPI. Now, at the time, women weren't allowed in the National Press Club, but there was a women's National Press Club.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, it happened because the women couldn't get into the National Press Club.
So before your time, some other woman set it up, and you became very active in that.
Yes.
And you became the president of that.
Right.
Now, why did you want to be president of the Women's National Press Club? What was the goal?
Well, I thought it was very good in terms of my profession, prestige, and I knew that it was a great club.
Now, you used that entry as the president of the Women's National Press Club to first start interviewing, I guess it was when Eisenhower was president, mm-hmm. and you did a very shocking thing. You invited a communist, Soviet communist, I guess you interviewed this person?
Oh, no. We knew that Nikita Khrushchev was coming to town, and
right.
it was the start of the coexistence, and where U.S. was reaching out to the Soviet Union. And so Khrushchev was coming, and so every press club in town sent an invitation, cabled him, saying, we'd love to have you as our speaker at a luncheon or dinner. And the Soviet embassy very wisely went to the State Department and said, what'll we do here? We have all these invitations. And the State Department said, of course you're going to the National Press Club. And we said, of course he's not. Because we want to be there, too, and we can't go to the club.
We said, meaning the Women's National
Press
Club. The Women's,
sorry.
Said, that's not fair. You can't send him there because we can't interview him.
And that's right, or even see him. So we went to the White House and talked to Jim Haggerty, who was the press secretary for President Eisenhower. And he made the entree with the State Department. We had a meeting there. And for the first time in history, they allowed a certain number of women to attend the one luncheon at the National Press Club, which we did, and that was when Khrushchev made a statement, we will bury you.
At that National Press Club.
That's right. So it was an extremely important statement on his part, and we got a good idea of what it was all about. So that was the last time we got in the press club. That was 1959, and we were not allowed to become members till 1971, when they were down on their uppers and needed our money.
They needed your money.
I do.
Well, now, how did your interviewing Khrushchev, how did that help you finally get your job that you have maintained for so long on the White House press corps?
Well, I didn't really interview him. I mean, we just
you were allowed in the club.
But then they sent the another woman who would top in the parliament in the Duma in Moscow.
Union, right.
So I invited her to speak at a luncheon, and
this is a Women's National Press Club luncheon.
The Women's National Press Club. Sorry, mm-hmm.
Right. So you invited the head of the Duma, the head of the Russian Parliament, to speak at the National Women's Press Club, and there was quite an uproar when that happened.
Yes, to invite a communist to speak. So, but we held our ground and insisted that we have her. And everybody came to luncheon, of course. They wanted to see this phenomena, a communist woman. Well, she was great, and very typical Soviet woman, very rosy cheeks and with a very dark suit, and, kind of zoptic. she was very good, but except she spoke the doctrine as usual.
So kind of zoptic. I don't know how many Arab Americans know some Yiddish like you do, but it's an interesting choice of words. Anyway, go ahead.
She was asked questions then, mm-hmm. and she was asked, why don't your women wear makeup? And she said, well, if they need it, they will, which I thought
was
a wonderful answer. And I was invited then to go to Russia, which I did, Soviet Union, I mean. And I was treated very royally, I must say, although I was the doctrine was being shoved at me. And I said, oh, they work so hard and they do this. And I began to think, oh, my goodness, geez, why don't we work harder? And so then I got to Paris, and I started looking around and thought, oh, they don't really work hard enough. But by 2 days, I was looking at all the beautiful women having the wonderful meals. And so I said, I understand the West now.
You understand why people like the West. But it's interesting because this trip to the Soviet Union and the willingness to invite a communist, invite the enemy, really, to come and speak to the National Press Club, that led to your following the Kennedys.
Well, no. It was because No, actually, there was no connection.
There was no connection? I thought that that gave you some a respect that it allowed you to sort of go to the next step.
Well, just being president of the Women's National Press Club was good for me. And then the UPI decided to expand its team at the White House. And they knew that the Kennedy family was very, you know, interesting and in the news. So I was added on to the staff.
And you were added on to cover Jackie, not John Kennedy.
Well, no, you don't go to the White House without covering men, women, children, animals, everything that moves.
Okay.
So I went there. I went there right after the inauguration day. And I sort of assigned myself from then on. I just kept going. And they said, okay, stay there.
So you just, UPI, you were invited on Inauguration Day, I guess.
Oh, I was assigned to it.
Assigned to it. But since then, you weren't invited. You just showed up and assumed it was your place and
like
took your place.
Like the man who came to dinner.
Right, right. And didn't. But women in 1961 were not covering hard news very often, were they? There were a few.
No, there were a few, yes.
But because of prejudice, most women were covering society pages, things like that?
That's right. When you applied for a job on a newspaper in the 40s and 30s, in the 40s, that's a turnabout for World War II. But in the 30s and 20s, you were assigned to cover women and the social life of a town.
But you covered everyone. You covered Jackie Kennedy
and
John
Kennedy. From the moment I stepped in.
So what did you think of John Kennedy as president? Particularly at that time.
Well, at that time and from now, he was my favorite president because I thought he was so inspired. He created the Peace Corps. He told young people to go into public service, that it could be the crown of their career. He knew the difference. He had been in war. And I also had the feeling that his time was short because he had a very fatal illness.
But although was that known at the time?
No, it wasn't known. Addison's disease.
Right, Addison's disease.
But he knew it.
He knew it, sure.
He lived in a different way as a consequence. Also, he said the most unbelievable thing, we're going to land men on the moon in a decade. Didn't live to see it, but we did it. And first, his first year in office, he invited the first class of astronauts to the White House and their wives for an informal dinner. And he said during the mix and mingle, do you think we could land men on the moon? And they said to him, sure, of course, absolutely. You never say no to a president. When they left, they said, is this guy nuts? Is he crazy?
Right.
Land on the moon?
Now, of course, you knew Robert Kennedy as well. I don't know. I mean, he was Attorney General at the time. He later ran for president. How would you compare Robert and John Kennedy?
I think that, of course, Robert
Bobby
never
Kennedy.
Became president.
Right.
But he was certainly, after Kennedy, his brother, died, he was fired up, really. He had a great sense of idealism of what the country should be. And he had a tremendous dynamic following, especially among young people.
And of course, Senator Teddy Kennedy just died,
they passed the torch.
Yes,
really.
He was in office from the 1960s until just a few days ago. What are your thoughts on Senator Kennedy?
I thought he became a great president. He made many mistakes in his youth, and when
a great senator, you mean?
Yes. And I think that he was outstanding, of course, on the social issues and the things he believed in and worked so hard. And the thing he had was the approval of both sides of the aisle. He made friends with the Republicans and so forth. But he brought the Kennedy idealism into reality.
Do you remember the very first question you asked a president of the United States? It would have been, it was John F. Kennedy, or what the subject matter was?
I've forgotten what I've asked, but I know that I was, at that time, when I was covering him in the first press conference, I was also assigned to close the press conference. And it was supposed to last a half hour, live television, by agreement between the networks and the White House. So I had wore two watches, and I got up. Kennedy had a tough question about some kind of import from Cuba, and he kept talking, trying to find the answer. You could see that he was really in a mud. So I finally got up, and I said, "Thank you, Mr. President." He said, "Thank you, Helen."
Because he saved him from having to answer that question.
That's right.
That's funny. Now, Lyndon Johnson, the next president, of course, had a very different air about him than John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy was very sophisticated, and Lyndon Johnson was, I'll let you use the words, a man of the people, shall we say.
That's true.
How did the White House differ from the Kennedy years to the Johnson years?
From Johnson?
From Kennedy to Johnson. Okay. Was it a big change? Well, they're both Democrats.
Johnson was the can-do man. He wanted to show that he got things done, and he had been Senate Majority Leader, so he knew every man's price on Capitol Hill, and he knew where all the bodies were buried,
right.
And he used all that knowledge to get the votes. He made the greatest contribution on the last half of the 20th century for social causes, the Great Society,
Civil rights.
Medicare, federal aid to education at all levels, starting with Head Start through college, public housing, environmental laws, I mean, you name it.
How did it feel in those days? Did you feel like the sky was the limit? I mean, you said you've always been a liberal. Is that fair to say? You've always been a liberal.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Why should I be anything else?
I wouldn't suggest you be
why
anything.
Why would anyone be
so
anything?
I'm curious, in these days, particularly before Vietnam really heated up and caused the country to be split apart, was there this feeling that liberals could do anything? I mean, from civil rights to housing to health care to that the sky was the limit? Or did you already feel like storm clouds were?
No, you always had opposition, but not as ugly as it is now. And not as polarized, and not as mean and cruel. I think right now the political atmosphere is almost deadly.
And at that time, people were more polite in their opposition? I mean, you did have Strom Thurmond, who was filibustering the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, filibustering, but there wasn't the mean-spirited. That unless my memory has totally faded, it was tough, sure, with the Southerners who were still upholding segregation and so forth. That was bad. But I think it was just the atmosphere I felt was very different and almost polite to the opposition.
Was it different questioning a new president, questioning Johnson from questioning Kennedy, or was it always about the same?
Oh, yeah, because Johnson didn't want to be questioned.
I see.
Kennedy had humor. He would laugh off things that he tried to deflect.
Right.
But Johnson would get mad. I mean,
he'd shout back at
a love-hate relationship with the press, yes. But I think it was, he really, really had a big heart. And I think he really understood politics so well. And he also knew when it's all over in terms of his Vietnam, that he couldn't fight against, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?
Were you angry at LBJ because of Vietnam?
Yes. I thought it was a wrong war, that we shouldn't have been there. Too many people being killed, too many people dying.
Now, of course, no president hated the press, I think it's fair to say, more than the next one, Richard Nixon. He considered the press his enemy, and I would suspect you were on the top of the list.
No, I didn't make the enemy's list.
You didn't make the enemy's list to Richard Nixon?
I don't know why.
I don't know. I guess he had so many. It was a very, very long list.
I think that he was angry at the press from the very beginning of his political career because of McCarthyism and so forth. And he never could quite find a place in terms of the press. He tried hard when he became president, but by this time the die was cast.
Do you have any memorable questions that you asked Richard Nixon, particularly when Watergate came? Did you ask very tough questions about a cover-up or anything like that?
I asked him a lot of questions about that, but I had one moment of feeling really remorse about myself because it was 1974. Just a short time, in fact, before he resigned. And he was the only president in our history to resign.
Right.
So I had become head of the Bureau for UPI, three-person bureau, big deal.
But you were the head of the three.
Big deal to me. And at the start of a news conference, the President Nixon called on me and congratulated me. And I came armed with a really tough question on it. It had to do with the tapes. And
right.
Very, very revealing. And
so you felt bad when he complimented you to ask him a tough
that's
question.
That's right. So I paused a minute and I thought, what are the American people going to think of me? Here I'm slapping this man in the face when he's being so nice. And then I thought, what will my peers think if I, bow to this moment? So I asked them the question, but I felt very bad.
You know, what you raise, I think, is a general question about journalism and the White House. We find it with George Bush. You find journalists want to please the president to get access to the president, but then if you want to please the president, how can you be a good journalist? I mean, it sounds like this is always a question in journalism. You want to be polite, you want to have access, but at the same time, you want to be tough.
Well, I want to be polite, and it's nice to have access. But I never want to please them, and I never bow to them, ever, because I think, one, they want to be elected. They're my public servant, your public servant. That's what they are. So they're no better than any American.
But do you find that there is pressure on you, on all journalists, to not be so hard on the president? Because if you do, they might cut off your access, they might cut off your mic, as later on we're going to get to, George Bush literally stopped calling on you because of your criticism.
That's true, and some presidents have declared very silently a reporter's persona non grata. That's true.
So how do you manage to ask the tough question and not get cut off? Where's the line?
Because I don't think there's any other place to go but the truth. And, you're not thinking of yourself when you want to be a journalist. You're thinking of the truth. You're trying to get the story, and I don't think you have to bow and scrape.
Do you think your questions have gotten harder from Kennedy on to Obama today? Have you gotten tougher, or have you always been tough?
I think I've always been tough, if that's what you call it.
Asking hard
but
questions.
But I think the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. I know for TV you want to keep the camera on you for 10 minutes, so you ask a question in four paragraphs. Not me. Why did you do it? What do you mean by that?
Sometimes the best way is a short question. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this, and if you want to call in and ask your questions of our guests, you can do so. 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back.
Here again, The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. My guest today has questioned 10 presidents, and it's my honor and privilege to question her. She is the Dean of the White House Press Corps. Her name is Helen Thomas. You can see her often in the front row, not always, but usually in the front row of the White House press room, asking tough questions of every president, from John F. Kennedy to Barack Obama. And you can question her, if you like, just by calling in. Pick up the phone and dial toll-free 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, and you can ask your questions of Helen Thomas. We're going sort of chronologically through this, with a little bit of jumps and starts back and forth. Richard Nixon was the first Republican president that you covered.
Yes, every day.
Did you feel a huge difference from the Democratic presidents, Kennedy and Johnson, to covering Nixon? Did you feel different as a reporter?
Well, I felt that he had a hostility to the press, and maybe pretty valid in a way, because he didn't feel he was treated right by the press from the moment he became a congressman. And he carried a lot of baggage. Maybe we did too. So it wasn't exactly a happy relationship. I think he went out of his way sometimes to be nice.
And you traveled with him even.
Yes. I was very lucky to go to China
on that
breakthrough trip, 1972.
And that was very surprising to people when Nixon went to China. It was.
It was.
Why was that?
Why? We had no relations with China for 20 years. And it was very clear that he was moving to divide and conquer. Found out that communism was not monolithic, and there was a real schism with Russia and China with a million troops on the border. So he wanted to exploit that.
When you heard about the Watergate break-in, did you think that this would be the kind of thing that could grow and take down a president, or did it seem very small?
No, I certainly didn't think that. And the press secretary, Ron Ziegler, dismissed it as a third-rate burglary.
Did you believe him at the time?
No. I mean, I thought that was very strange, but I didn't have the kind of the Woodward and Bernstein attitude and didn't have the time that they did. In the end, Watergate, Washington Post, had 18 reporters on that covering it.
Did you cover Watergate? Did you cover those details?
On the fringes, and certainly in the White House, and certainly covering with Nixon, I saw him deteriorate and saw the pain of the family, and they knew it was all over. Nothing could put Humpty Dumpty together again. It was as inevitable, inexorable as a Greek tragedy. There was no way he could come back.
Were you surprised by some of the things that we've later heard on the tapes in the White House? Were you surprised, first of all, that there were tapes in the White House? Did that surprise you?
Yes, and it surprised everyone. When it surprised Nixon to have it come back at him.
And then, of course, Nixon resigned, and we had this president that had never been elected by the American people. He wasn't elected vice president. He wasn't elected president. Gerald Ford seemed to come out of nowhere. But he was probably a relief after Richard Nixon, I suppose.
He aspired to be Speaker of the House. That was his great ambition.
Right.
And he said the long nightmare is over when he took office. So
was the press nicer to Gerald Ford than they were to Richard Nixon?
Yes. And he was nicer to us. That wasn't a question of nice, but he had been on the Hill with reporters for years, and he knew them and so forth. So,
of course, at that time, we had a great recession then, and people were very much suffering under Gerald Ford. Then comes this new president, Jimmy Carter, that no one had ever heard of, the ex-governor of Georgia, a new face in the White House. What did you think of Jimmy Carter?
I thought very well of him, and I thought he was a good president, although he certainly was not getting along with Congress, even though he had a Democratic Congress. They didn't understand him. When they come to the White House, they came to the White House. They went in the same door, came out the same door they went in. Actually, there was no contact. They didn't like each other, really.
Why was that? Was it just a challenge, a power challenge, or was there something else there?
Different personalities, I think. You know, he didn't schmooze with Speaker O'Neill. Carter was not that type and so forth. I think they didn't understand him. He had a spiritual side, and I think that he was more of a loner.
And schmoozing is important in Washington, right?
Pardon?
Schmoozing is important in Washington.
Absolutely.
When you say, you say he didn't schmooze well, what does that mean? Going out for drinks, joking around with people, why is that so important?
All of that and more. Why is it important? Because it sets up a camaraderie. After 6 o'clock, we're friends again, and even though we fight on the Hill and so forth.
And journalists would schmooze with politicians. In fact, they still do, right? They still go out and have drinks together.
Sure, you have to
so
do
forth.
That. I mean, you can find out a lot more that way.
You can. Is it fair if the politician has had a little bit too much to drink and they talk to you? That's fair.
Absolutely.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
About to find out what's going on.
So you sit back.
I mean, they're big boys, and you're not exploiting children or anything.
And do you find that the reporters that don't have drinks with the politicians don't get to ask the questions later on?
I don't think they necessarily have drinks. It's just when the congressmen talk more, senators talk more, they want the publicity and so forth. So they become acquainted with reporters who are covering them day by day.
I assume, though, it's harder to schmooze with the president, to have drinks with the president, than it is with a congressman or a senator. It's hard to get that kind of access.
I think he tried, and he extended a hand of friendship, but they didn't quite understand him.
Later, the next president, of
but
course...
But he did win the Nobel Peace Prize.
He did win the Nobel Peace Prize.
And he still works very hard for peace all over the world.
The next president, of course, is Ronald Reagan. What did you think of him?
Everybody liked Reagan in a sense because he was pretty friendly and so forth. I thought that he was about as far right as I had ever met a president.
But the
very conservative. Ketchup was a vegetable.
Right. But the fact that he was friendly took the edge off. The people didn't realize how conservative he was.
I think that's true. I have to tell you the story that I really think that Mrs. Reagan pushed her husband to go to Moscow, and because Gorbachev was opening the window, and she felt that there could be a real rapprochement between U.S. and Soviet Union. So they went to Moscow, and it opened Reagan's eyes. He saw that the Russians laughed, they cried, they were human, and he said so. And when we got back to Washington, I said to him, Mr. President, do you think if you had gone to Moscow 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you might have found out that the Russians laughed, they cried, they're human? Nope, he said, they've changed.
They've changed. He said that in the press conference.
No, it was the private conversation.
They've changed. They used to be awful people, but now they're good people.
He found out that they were human.
I actually have a clip of you talking about President Reagan that I'd like to play, and then I'm going to ask you to comment on it. This is your discussion of why the president would or would not answer some questions.
When President Reagan first took over the Oval Office, we would throw questions at President Reagan, and he would answer them. Well, his three top aides were apoplectic. They didn't know what was coming out of his mouth. They taught the president to say, this is not a press conference. And they had him quite trained on that. And one day we asked him about what was happening, and he said to us, I can't answer that. We said, why? He said, because they won't let me. And he pointed to Baker, Meese, and Deaver, who were standing behind, very grim. They won't let me. I said, but you're the president.
So, I mean, how often is it that you feel that a president wants to tell you what's going on, but is constrained? They won't let me. Is that more than just Ronald Reagan?
I think they war game almost everything they say publicly now, especially, and they get, they're briefed by their advisors and probably told not to answer a lot of questions. But they're supposed to be very accountable. And I think that they're so wary now. They get into trouble every time they open their mouths practically, or they irritate a certain segment. Once in a while, I think they really speak their minds. Maybe they pay the price.
Well, does that mean that when you are trying to figure out a question, that you try to get the president off his talking points? Do you pose a question in such a way that you want to get him not to give you these sort of standard stock answers he's been trained to give?
I think you definitely try to get a different answer, and you'll war game yourself in a way, because you say, I know this is what he's going to say. Get off that cliche if you can.
So how do you do that? How do you pose a question and get... I'm curious, what do you think is... I don't know if you have an answer, but give me some of your most successful questions, questions that you think you've asked that have really gotten the president off his talking points and said some things that maybe he wished he hadn't said.
Well, I don't think that I've exactly been that good, but I do think that a president, you have to understand what a press conference is. It's the only forum in our society where a president can be questioned on a regular basis. So we carry the burden or the responsibility of really asking the important questions. When I worked for a wire service, I would always ask the headline of the day, whatever it had to do with, could be domestic or a war or the other things. As a columnist now, I sort of ask a kind of a different question, mainly trying to ask why they think we ought to be in Afghanistan. Why did President Bush invade Iraq when everything he said was not true.
Now, as the wire service, you got to ask the first question.
First or second?
First or second.
Right.
And so you did that ever since, was since Kennedy, since Johnson? You were asking the first or second question? When did that start?
Yeah, well, it's actually, the head of our bureau was Merriman Smith, the great, great reporter who won the Pulitzer in Dallas. And so actually I started really asking the questions with, I guess, with Johnson.
With Johnson. Mm-hmm. And you got the first or the second question.
Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously that's a wonderful privilege. You got to sort of set the tone.
Oh, yeah. So you don't have to holler and shout like a hyena or something.
But the first question, you say it has to be on the headlines of the day. That's sort of the standard practice. People understood. You don't
that's
ask
right.
a very detailed question on a small issue as the first question.
That's right. Well, it also sets the tone for the press conference. If it's health care or war, Vietnam, or all of these things, where you have to focus on that.
And then only when you're a columnist, then you would be able to ask some of the more detailed questions.
More depth, I think, in, as to why, the question of why, trying to build reasons for actions on the president.
Which president of the 10 you've covered do you think was most forthcoming, most answering your questions, and which do you think was least answering the questions?
None of them were forthcoming.
None of them were forthcoming! Not a one of them!
No, I'm teasing, but they don't want to be forthcoming. I mean, once they step into the Oval Office, they think the information is their private preserve, and they can dole it out on their own terms, but... So it isn't that.
So none of them are forthcoming.
And I think most of this stuff should be in the public domain. And that's where we really differ.
Do you think any president was the most secretive? Would it be Nixon or George Bush?
They're all secretive.
They're all secretive. It's not just those two. Okay, so after Reagan was president came Bush Sr., George Bush's father. What did you think of him?
Well, I thought he tried to do a good job, and... He was really caught between the conservatives, and I think he would have been a little more middle of the road. I think he knew more about foreign affairs. He had the good sense not to go into Baghdad after the liberation of Kuwait. And he wrote about it. He said that there'd be house-to-house fighting, there'd be civil war. He was so accurate on that, his son didn't listen.
And, of course, the next president was Bill Clinton. What did you think of Bill Clinton?
I think he did a good job, but he won't wind up on Mount Rushmore. I mean, I think...
All because of Monica Lewinsky or for other reasons?
No, I think that he lost his chance for greatness, not because of Monica Lewinsky, but because I think he could have contributed much more, although he did leave a surplus in the Treasury and he did the right things like that. But it seemed to me... that he had the energy and enthusiasm to take on a bit more social causes.
Of course, President Clinton had a Republican Congress from 1994. Yeah. So for six of his
eight
years.
They never gave him a minute, a second of peace in office. They couldn't stand they had to give up the White House. And
did you think that Hillary Clinton's health care plan, do you think it had a chance of success? Do you think it was, what did you think of that when it happened?
I thought it was too complex, too Pavlovian. I don't think anyone understood it. And she missed the boat from the beginning. She didn't touch base with Congress, or who might have been able to guide her a little better. So I thought it was sorry.
Is President Obama's health care plan better than Hillary Clinton's health care plan?
I don't know what his health plan is yet, and that's the fallacy. That's the problem. I think he should lay it out 1, 2, 3, 4. This is what this plan does. Not have 4,400 pages or whatever it is. And people don't understand it. They're able to fabricate falsehoods and so forth about it because nobody knows what's really in it. He should have laid down exactly what he wanted. He did try to touch base and get a bipartisan support. He's not going to get that. Drop it.
and do something that's very simple so people can
say,
understand
this
it.
Is what I want, and this is what the American people should have, and 47 million people with no health care.
I've often argued that even though it may not be the best solution, that the way that you could cover everyone and the American people could understand it is simply to raise Medicare to everyone. Let everyone of all ages do it. People know what Medicare is, and they wouldn't be scared to think it's something else.
And it would be easy because everyone has a number, Social Security, from the day they're born, practically.
So you think Bill Clinton could have accomplished more? Do you think he could have accomplished more even with the Republican Congress being as hostile as it was?
No, but when he first came into office.
In those first 2 years.
So, yes.
So you don't agree
with
historians
very crucial.
That say he went too far in the first 2 years, and the pushback is what created it.
Well, there was a pushback from the moment he stepped into the office. Yes, I do think that hurt him a lot. But you fight against that. You go to the people. He had a lot of charisma.
That he did. What did you think of the whole Lewinsky affair? It's almost embarrassing to even talk about it. I mean, he was impeached. Wasn't removed from office, but he was impeached.
I didn't think he should have been impeached for that. There are too many.
Did it surprise you that they went that far with it?
No, because they never gave him a moment in the White House. Then not 1 second when he wasn't being investigated.
Of course.
And he should have been smart enough to know that he had, you know, was not free.
Now,
glass house.
At the end, I guess it was in 2000, that you can correct me if I got the date wrong, that UPI was bought by really Reverend Sun Myung Moon, his outfit. Was that in 2000, the end of Bill Clinton?
Yes.
And you quit a job that you'd held for more than 40 years, or almost 57 years.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that?
Because I didn't think that it was a bridge too far.
Yeah, you could work for UPI, but not if it was owned by Reverend Sun Myung Moon. What has happened to UPI now in the last 10 years or so since it's owned? You never hear about it anymore.
It's lost so much ground. It's shame because there should be competition.
There's really just the Associated Press and I guess Reuters.
Reuters, that's right.
And there were always the big three. And now there's just two, I guess, wire services.
What's happened to newspapers all over? I mean,
what does a wire service do? Why is a wire service important, separate from a newspaper or a columnist or anything?
Because when you write for a wire service, it's right down the line. You're serving all different points of view and so forth. So it's just the facts, ma'am. I mean,
you try to be very objective.
That's right. So I wrote for wire service, even though I had an opinion on everything, including the color of the walls. But I wasn't able to put it in the copy, and you had to watch your verbs and adverbs and so forth, so you wouldn't indicate any bias. Now I write a column where
you can say whatever you want.
Not everything, but pretty
much anything.
Yes.
And it's interesting, I think a lot of people saw you differently once George Bush Jr. became president. And not recognizing that your role had changed, that for the past eight presidents, you were the role of the wire service. You had to ask a fairly objective question.
And write straight news.
Right. But when Bush became president, George Bush Jr., you were no longer with the wire service, and you could ask some pretty tough questions.
Well, I was asking tough questions all the time, but I could write a little differently. In fact, when the editor looked at my first columns, he said, "Where's the edge?" I said, "What?
Really?
Your opinion. My what?" And then I started thinking, well, who do I hate today? Because that's the way you write a column.
Right.
You know, you're against everything.
Right.
Once in a while, you can be for something.
Now, you have famously said, I'm going to show you a clip, that George Bush is the worst president ever, and you got in a little trouble with the White House because of that. Let me play a little clip for you.
President ever. He is the worst president in all of American history.
I never said that on the record, but it certainly got out.
It got out.
Yes. I think that there's a room for improvement.
You can't really blame him if you're calling him the worst president for him saying, you know what, I'm not going to call him.
Well, I agree with you.
So what do you think?
I wasn't surprised that he didn't call on me.
What do you think happened today? Why do you think? I know you were in the gridiron. I was at that dinner, and you did a nice performance, skits, and you were, you know, a satirical skits on the president, the vice president, and everybody else. And you did an excellent job, as you always do, singing and dancing. But what happened? What do you think happened?
I think we smoked the peace pipe. I think that, you know, there's a different rapport now, which is good.
Did you talk to him privately or something? Did you meet him?
No, not really, but I sort of felt bad for the things that I had said that were not supposed to be transmitted. I sort of apologized.
You did, all right. So he called on you today.
Very nice of him to call on me.
And you asked him a tough question.
So he didn't call on you.
Mm-mm.
And this would be the first president ever that basically blackballed you, said, I'm not going to call on Helen
Thomas.
That's
right. He had a right to do that.
And that was how long? A year, 2 years he didn't call on you?
No, went for several months.
Several months it was. And you say he had a right to do that.
Well, yes, it's his privilege.
Does the president have a right to choose which journalists he can call on?
I mean, they think so. In terms of the wire service, it's tradition that they call on them.
That they always call on them first.
Yeah, the others you can, and now they call on the regulars, network.
Right. What's interesting to me is if old press conferences from Kennedy on through, I guess it's Reagan, maybe it's even George Bush Sr., people shouted out, Mr. President, Mr. President. That doesn't happen anymore.
No, I loved it. Pandemonium.
You liked that? Who ended that? Clinton ended that?
I think Bush.
Was it Bush that ended that?
I'm not quite sure.
I'm not sure either. Well, someone will look it up and then write
it. It's supposed to be a little more orderly.
But when you say the president has a right to call on the journalists they want, I mean, how much is it tradition? You say tradition, wire services, and then they call what, ABC, CBS, NBC?
Usually that's the way it goes.
And then anybody they want. So does it happen often that a president refuses, just says, I'm not going to call on Helen Thomas or I'm not going to call on somebody else?
Sure.
Because sure, people heard about it because of you, because, you know, people were used to you asking questions and they noticed when you weren't.
That's right.
And so I think it was embarrassing. You say you sort of apologized.
I felt that I had hurt somebody's feelings and then you don't want to do that.
But you still consider him the worst president ever.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
So how do you do that? How do you express an opinion? You have absolute right as an American citizen to say he's the worst. I agree with you. I think he's the worst president, certainly in my lifetime. How do you express an opinion and then apologize for something that you really believe?
Well, because I think that you feel that the intent was not to hurt them, really, and that was, I didn't say it out loud. A young man came to me after I spoke in L.A. at the Society of Professional Journalists, and I pretty well bashed President Bush, the last one.
I do it all the time.
And he came up to me and he said, this young man, turns out he was a reporter, a sports reporter for Torrance, California. Hmm. He said to me, I've never asked anyone to sign my a book before. Would you sign? And I'm preening. Oh, you never ask anyone? Sure, I'll be happy to. Then he said, you look very sad. I said, I am. I'm covering the worst president. I thought I was talking
to a fan off the record. And
anyway, went around the world about 10 times.
And that hurt you, I guess. I mean, that hurt your career because when the president decides not to call on you?
Well, it wasn't exactly pleasant, but he had the right.
But you made up with him, and his press secretaries were asking you questions, were letting you ask questions on through the end. I remember you always seemed to ask the toughest questions. You know, he would say...
You have one chance in the barrel.
You would say, why did you invade Iraq? And he would talk about Afghanistan and 9/11. You'd say, but Iraq has nothing to do with 9/11. And then he'd say, I've answered your question. And then you'd ask another question. When do you give up? Or maybe the answer is never.
Well, you give up because you know they're not going to answer anymore. And at some point, You shouldn't. I don't want to take anyone else's time, too. They have the right to ask questions.
Our current president, President Obama, has a very different attitude towards you, former President Bush. He celebrated his birthday with you. It's on the same date. What do you think of President Obama?
I think he has a good conscience. I think his heart's in the right place. I think he wants to do the right thing. But I think he's not bold enough.
Do you think he could do more?
I think he has to muster more courage to face the opposition and say, this is what we want. This is what the country should have.
And unlike Bill Clinton, he doesn't have a Republican Congress. He has a Democratic Congress, so he could muster the will that Lyndon Johnson perhaps did.
I think blue dog Democrats are Republicans.
So he's got his own problems. What could he do more to push his agenda? Explain things more simply to people?
I definitely think he ought to present a bill. I mean, don't leave it to these blue dogs. They're not going to give him the bill that he wants or anything else. They're going to take care of the health insurance companies and the drug companies, and they're pouring in more than $1 million, a day, I heard. But that has to be wrong, but they're pouring a lot of money into it.
Helen, when I talk with you, an hour goes by very, very quickly. There are many, many details
maybe
I
talk
asked you.
Too much.
No. It's really been a privilege and an honor to have you here on the Inside Scoop. I really appreciate you
Thank
coming
you.
In as my guest.
Thank
if you have a question or a comment on today's show, let us know. Post it at radioinsidescoop.com. Let us know what you thought of it. Helen Thomas, thanks again.